Well, welcome. Welcome, everybody. It's an honor to be here. I'm Steve Wellham from Lead East Side Insight, one of the local Dharma leaders. And this evening, we're going to have the opportunity to sit together. And then we'll have some exploration of the subject of renunciation. And I think this is an interesting month because there's four different persons taking the seat. And it's kind of beautiful that we're not trying to coordinate in any way. We're just letting it flow. So that's a good thing, you know. It's like a lot of trust and trusting the Dharma there. So you got this kind of smorgasbord or something like that. A loving smorgasbord. So I'm here to offer some dharma about renunciation, which is such an interesting area. And I think it's, again, splendid that four different people are talking about it in whatever ways are in their hearts over this month. So that's really lovely. So about this time last year, I had the great honor of being invited to an iftar, and that's the daily evening meal after the sun sets for the fast of Ramadan for Muslim folks. And after the meal, I got into this exchange with the master of ceremonies for the event, this very devout and focused Muslim woman with a lot of flexibility in her heart. And we just had we really communicated. It was really great. We sort of were able to transpose our perspectives and hear each other. It was a really beautiful, beautiful, kind of uplifting exchange. And what was wonderful was how much we were aligned in the whole arena of renunciation. It was really striking about how crucial it is, and it's not a matter of self-denial, and it really opens a door to freedom and joy and awakening. And this woman, she'd chosen to wear a headscarf since she was 17. She was fasting every day for a month, and she was totally happy and free. So I want to explore renunciation this evening in kind of that way, you know, how it can be a help on the path to clear our way forward and to bring us freedom. And since we're resonating with different traditions a little bit, by the way, I'm prone to quoting, reading quotes in stuff I offer, so bear with me. People who know way more than me, it's good to hear their words. So I'll start with a quote from Ramakrishna, a great Hindu master, one of the great beings of the last few centuries, and copied from his amazing work, the Gospel of Ramakrishna, and asked about how to succeed on the path in a busy world. He said, "One succeeds if one develops a strong spirit of renunciation. Give up at once with determination what you know to be unreal." Give up at once with determination what you know to be unreal. That kind of captures the heart of the matter right there. So we'll be exploring this evening, turning away from shedding, letting go of that which isn't real, that just gets in the way, that obstructs us. And we have to have determination, like you said, because things can be alluring. The things that obstruct us. But at the same time, this becomes a matter of discernment, because ultimately we know it to be unreal, those things we're letting go of, renouncing, if you will. And then later on in the evening, I want to explore how this is a gateway to awakening, because it gets pretty deep, as the Dharma always does. And part of why this word renunciation in English is challenging for us Westerners is our Judeo-Christian heritage. You know, because we think about it and you get these medieval images of monastics in cold monasteries, self-flagellating, whatever. You know, it was a difficult and wonderful period in monasticism, but not easy. So we think of it as giving up what we really want or what would be fun, because to do otherwise would be wrong or sinful. That's kind of the framework that a lot of us have kind of built into our psyches. And from this point of view, it does seem like kind of a wretched and painful business to be giving up the fun stuff. Like, really? What's the point of that? But actually, from the path of Dharma, from what the Buddha taught, is quite the opposite. It's giving up that which does not matter, that which we know to be unreal. And when we do that, a greater happiness emerges. The Buddha said in the Samyutta Nikaya 22:33, he said, "Whatever, monks, is not yours, abandon it. When that is abandoned by you, this will be for your welfare and happiness." So this gets back to the conversation with the Muslim woman, because she was a spiritual being. And she talked about what she was shedding during Ramadan. She didn't do entertainment. She fasted all day. She stayed away from distractions in general. It really helped her focus on what was important to her. She let go of what was unreal. And she was glowing. She was great. It was really cool. So on the path of Buddha Dharma, this renunciation thing is a mixture of letting go and having things fall away. They start to evolve together as we work along the path. So the letting go can take some decisions and willpower, especially here in 2024 when we're drenched with entertaining stuff. As you know, there's a massive industry trying to get us to spend money to be entertained. So it takes some consciousness to work with all this. But the letting go and the falling away are interwoven. And as you work on the path, you kind of see how they interconnect. But, and in some ways I'm going to touch on the same point several times because they're worth renoting. Because the wider view is this takes us towards freedom. It isn't grim at all. It's letting go of that which binds or obscures. The Buddha said, and this is one of my favorite quotes in the Dharma, so I bring it into teachings all the time. It's in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses. The Buddha said, the mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. So if you think of it that way, if that's the nature of our mind, why would we want to do anything that would obscure that luminous nature? What would be the point of that? So in a sense, this clarifies just how simple the Dharma is. You know, on the path to awakening, we're not constructing anything, creating anything. We're just peeling away that which is in the way so that the luminous nature of mind can emerge. These visiting defilements. And this renunciation is all around, in a way, around visiting defilements. So it isn't a chore, renunciation. It's the loosening of bonds. It's peeling away limitations that may have accumulated this lifetime, maybe lifetimes. You know, some of our stuckness came from somewhere. And just think if we didn't have to have it. So this way of seeing things, it sheds a different light on, I'm going to get into lists kind of briefly, but some lists that, three lists of five things, which are some of the, in the Dharma, some of the most like seemingly lugubrious lists, the five precepts, the five hindrances, and the five skandhas. And in terms of renunciation, they take on a different light. The most immediate context for most people in terms of how we might shed through renunciation is the five precepts, which is the ethical standards of sila in the Dharma. And for the lay people, there are things that we might be instinctively inclined to do, but the Buddha suggests maybe not so helpful. And you probably know the list, training in, it's always a training, training in not killing, not stealing, not sexual misconduct, not abuse of intoxicants, not lying. So we train in all those because our first impulse often is the opposite. You know, we're tempted to do, maybe it's anyone ever taken a pen from an office storeroom, you know, or had an extra beer that you maybe didn't really need after cycling, or even little things, you know. But we kind of got to pay attention. And we get this little, I noticed in myself when I did that, a little tingle of payoff, like, ooh, I got this good thing. I did this thing. You know, this is going to be fun or something. The pen, the free pen, really? But you get this little weird thing. But when we start to look in terms of renunciation, the whole thing kind of shifts, because like, what's that going to get you? That little tingle. It's not worth anything. You let go of that, and that's what's taking us to freedom. So it brings the letting go brings light, inner light, into our lives. And remember the luminous mind thing? It brings light into our lives when we don't step over those boundaries. So we're not repressing ourselves, we're unbinding ourselves by cultivating sila, ethics. And then the five hindrances, grasping, avoidance, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt, these are the things that kind of slow us down in practice, nail us down, slog us down. There are places where we tend to get stuck in like a loop of selfing, of grasping, of attachment. And they get in the way of awareness. That's what they do. They get in the way of that clear, luminous nature. And there are places where we get stuck around selfing. So to be able to let go of those, be mindful of them when they arise and work through them, is often there's an attachment, something to renounce, attached to those hindrances to let go of. And then the last, the five skandhas, or aggregates, it's about the stickiness of selfing, you know, the way we're all so self-involved. It's all about me. As you may know, the five are form, vedanas, perception, volition, and consciousness, and together they make up a sense of sticky self. My body, my pleasure, what I want. And we adhere to these with an intensity, so all of those are doorways into letting go, into this freedom. In the Samyutta Nikaya 22-26, I feel like, you know, it's cool to get the citations because you might want to go look at these even. Buddha said, "The pleasure and joy that arise in dependence on form, this is enjoyment in form. That form is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. This is the danger in form. The removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust. In regard to form, this is the escape from form." So he goes on through all the four skandhas. It's an escape. You know, it's escape from all the ways that we get entangled. Because that's often the problem, right? We get all entangled into my little sphere, and we get all stuck there, and that's not so free. That's like neurotic, when we're all attached. And you can see how this is tied to our mindfulness practice. Because when we're mindful, when we're really paying attention, then these boundaries get clearer, things that we want to let go of rather than get stuck. I guess renounce, you could say, but things where we don't attach, we let go. Because what does it bring us? It gets clearer when we're really watching what's happening. Like, you know, have you ever had an experience when you ever had an experience when someone's handing out pie and you take the biggest piece? You could have taken the smallest piece so someone else would get the biggest piece, but you took the biggest piece. Or if you're in a checkout line or you're sort of jockeying, you sort of kind of dive ahead of the other person a little bit because they paused, and, you know, that kind of thing. And if we're mindful in that moment, kind of watch what's happening. It's like, what was that about, you know? All it did was put a little barrier between this and that person, a little bit of grasping, a little that inner light, that luminosity, just got a little dimmer in that moment. So when we're paying attention, mindfulness really helps us see where to go in terms of renunciation. It makes it really natural. Because like I was saying, if the nature of mind is luminous and it's obscured by visiting defilements, why would we want to do anything that would make those defilements worse or stickier? So this kind of clarifies over time, over the journey of practice. It gets clearer and clearer how to work this. And that's what's so interesting about renunciation, because, you know, sometimes it can be hard in the beginning, and then it becomes more and more obvious about the letting go, about why it's worth it, about why it really helps us. And the outer renunciation we're talking about, you know, dropping specific things, becomes an inner renunciation. And we're going to talk about that a little more, but that's where it really starts to take us toward what this path is about, you know, the freedom that this path is about. But you can just see it in your mindfulness practice, that when we're paying attention, it starts to dissolve the very connectedness, the very stickiness that would make it hard to let go, that would make it hard to renounce. It doesn't become renouncing anymore. It becomes kind of free-handed. For instance, you know, training in our mindfulness practice, become aware of pleasant and unpleasant. That's a lot of where this lands. Pleasant and unpleasant, second foundation of mindfulness. And there's nothing wrong with pleasant or unpleasant. It's just like, that's how it is. You just experience. Ice cream is pleasant. Toothache is unpleasant. Fresh breeze is pleasant. Headache is unpleasant. But grasping at any one of those, that's the problem. So if we can be mindful, that's where mindfulness keeps helping, be mindful of pleasant and unpleasant, then this renunciation thing, it gets easier, because you can see it's just a treadmill. If you just try to grasp at the pleasant and push away the unpleasant, then you're spending your life thrashing around on grasping and aversion. It's not freedom. And this can be funny, and I sort of hesitated about sharing a tiny bit about my life, but I guess I will. Because I had this, it's been funny about the Dharma and stuff that I used to think was pleasant. I grew up, I'm giving away my privilege, I grew up around sailboats on Long Island Sound in Connecticut Shore. So I grew up sailing a lot, and I really liked it, and I used to sail all the time, and thought I'd sail all my life. And now I don't. And, you know, it's a lovely thing to do. I mean, it's really wholesome. Sailing is so cool. You stick me in a boat, put a tiller on my hand, I'd be happy to do that. But I just don't go out of my way to do it. I just don't try anymore. It just doesn't matter anymore. It's almost surprising. And it's sort of how stuff falls away. And I know a lot of people that get in deeply in the Dharma, they start to see that. These little entertainment things just don't matter so much anymore. There's something deeper going on. Does anybody have any? Does that ring a bell for any of y'all? See some nods? Yep. And I've had, on the flip side of that, you know, I've had the privilege of being around some Buddhist monastics over many years, especially in the last few with Clear Mountain around here. And I've been around those guys, Ajahn Nisibo and Ajahn Kovalo, quite a bit. And it's really helped me, I sort of absorbed a deeper, more energetic understanding of renunciation of this very freedom that we're kind of talking about. Because with those guys and other monastics I've met, it's not like they're struggling to let go. It's like it just doesn't land anymore. They're doing a whole other thing. It just doesn't matter anymore. And you can really learn. You can learn from that. You can see what that means in our own lives. It says in the Dhammapada, number 290, if by surrendering a slight happiness one might realize a great happiness, the wise person should give up the slight happiness considering the greater one. Doesn't that make sense? Give up the little one to get the greater one? And these monastics, some things I've seen, they have this kind of inner glow. It's just cooking. It's like underneath. They have this inner glow. And you see, as you're around them, it does not hinge upon optimal conditions. Like, they go out and do alms rounds once a day. And, you know, sometimes they get one croissant or nothing. Okay, I guess I'm fasting today. Same glow. Or Ajahn Nisibo, two winters ago, when he had a cracked foot, or I can't remember what he had, but he was on crutches. And he had to walk on crutches about a mile and a half to the Southworth Ferry, get off at the Coleman Dock, walk all the way up to Pike Place in a driving rain on January 13th or whatever. And he'd come and walk it up. It's like, oh man. And same glow. Did not matter. Pretty amazing. Glow is cool. Glow is good. So that's kind of what I'm about. In comparison, I go to a gym. The other day, I was at the gym. A guy had a Lamborghini SUV. I swear there is such a thing. There is a Lamborghini SUV. I looked it up. $230,000. 0-60 in 4 seconds. 650 horsepower. He did not look happy. That dude was uptight. And so this wasn't paying off. It wasn't working out for him, this Lamborghini that he got. Just saying. It might have been worth letting go of, even. So, one thing that the Buddha says many, many times in the suttas, and this is a challenge to us, he said, household life is crowded and dusty. Life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to leave the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Isn't that beautiful? So it's not easy for us lay people because we've got all these complications. We're not monastics. This renunciation thing is complicated, but it's doable, totally doable. We just have to look at it and see what it means and unpack it and bring it to life. And then it's okay. And it's really, you know, this is a goofy time here in the 21st century. Like I said, there's like the best and the brightest are trying to distract us, you know, with whatever, all this entertainment. My wife and I moved. We downsized. And she said, let's not bring a TV. And we went, oh, okay. So we didn't. We don't have a TV anymore. It's kind of amazing not having a television because you don't do that anymore. I mean, we can look at a thing on a 13-inch big screen like this. That's about it. But, you know, not having that thing coming at you, it's actually pretty cool. You can kind of settle in a little bit. Yeah, so, you know, a lot of Dharma life, it's hard in the beginning, easy in the end. And that's how it is with this particular facet, can be, renunciation. But that's okay. And to cop to that, to understand that's how the progression works, then it gets easier. You sort of know where you're going. It's going to get easier. And you can see. And the other part is, you know, I bet everybody here, compared to a lot of people, compared to the Lamborghini guy, you've already let go of a lot that you know doesn't matter. It's just tinsel. You know, you've let go already, focusing on what's important. There's a sutta called Delight in Forms, Samyutta Nikaya 35:136. And the Buddha says, monks, devas and humans, delight in forms, are delighted with forms, rejoice in forms. With the change, fading away, and cessation of forms, devas and humans dwell painfully. Devas and humans delight in sounds, delight in odors, delight in tastes, delight in tactile objects, delight in mental objects, are delighted with mental objects, rejoice in mental objects. With the change, fading away, and cessation of mental objects, devas and humans dwell painfully. So that's not such a good deal, is it, to be dwelling painfully? So this delighting in things, you know, that's fine. I mean, the Dalai Lama will eat ice cream and smile about it, but he doesn't seek it, and he doesn't mind if he doesn't have it. You know, rejoice, delight, but then let go and don't seek after. That is kind of the trick. I want to take that sort of second step, because this gets really interesting, how connected renunciation is with awakening itself, with what the Buddha was really pointing at in an ultimate sense. And Sanyutta Nikaya 35:118, the Buddha said, there are lords, he's talking to a deva. Yep, he's talking to a deva. He says, which is a god. Gods are always appearing at Jetavada Monastery and they come floating down in a great cloud of light. It's pretty cool. I haven't had it happen, but supposedly it happened many times in India there. Said, there are, Lord of the Devas, mental objects cognizable by the mind that are wished for, desired, agreeable, of a pleasing nature, connected with sensuality, enticing. If a monk or a person does not delight in them, does not welcome them, and does not remain holding to them as he does so, His consciousness does not become dependent on them and stand clinging to them. A monk without clinging attains nibbana. This is the cause, this is the reason why some beings here attain nibbana in this present life. So that's a radical connection he just made, that this renunciation thing, letting go of, not clinging, that just walks you right into nibbana. It's one of the doorways. So it's not just like kind of trying to be pure and nice. It's like actually a doorway to awakening, or a big chunk of our doorway to awakening. You know, that's one of the amazing things about the Dhamma is, if, for one thing, the Buddha's incessantly focused on nibbana, even for us lay people, that we can really wake up. And secondly, there are many different ways, many different doorways that get there, which is cool, because you can work different facets of it at different times according to what's working with you. But this nibbana one's close to the vest, you know, where we could deal with it all the time in little incremental bits, and they add up. And I say this with great respect to the guy with the Lamborghini, but it's the opposite of that. And he may be the kindest person in the world, I don't know, so I don't mean to judge him, but, you know, these little awakenings that we do, they add up and they take us toward nibbana. That's the deal. So I want to touch on two points that help sort of unpack this. One is that awakening, enlightenment, is not something we accomplish, it's something that gets revealed. And the second one is, there's no I who gets enlightened. There's no I who gets enlightened. And this relates to renunciation. So I'm going to break it down real quick. Not something we accomplish. You know, we tend, some of us, maybe me sometimes, to make it kind of like a project. You know, like we're rebuilding a car or something. Or whatever that's a guy thing. There may be women car rebuilders here. So forgive me, but we tend to make a thing out of it. You know, we're going to create this thing. But it's not like that. It's actually our innate nature, is already there, that luminous nature is already there underneath, just covered, obscured by visiting defilements. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of a joke in the Northwest, right, when the actual sun comes up in the spring and people are saying, oh my God, what is that thing? Because it's been like gray for the last 4 months straight. And that's kind of how we are, you know? We're sort of like at the end, we're sort of like March in the Northwest in terms of our psyche some of the time. We have this inner light covered up by clouds. We're so used to it, we don't even know it's there. But this awakening thing is a gradual clearing of the clouds. And how we live, the choices we make, the renunciation of letting go of things that don't matter, is part of the deal. It's part of what gets us there. And then in terms of the there's no I to be awakened, you know, when we're doing our mindfulness practice, we start to see that this self thing is just a construct. You can't find it. It falls apart. You've probably seen that in various ways in your mindfulness practice. The skandhas that's a real thing. And so this stickiness, that's the problem, that's the cloud obscuring the light. This self, you know, the ways in which we're completely self-involved, it actually starts to fall apart. And so there's no I who becomes awakened, but rather it's the falling apart that is awakening. You know, the way we start to see through this construct of grasping and being self-focused and wanting me to have the good experience and me to have the better experience than the other person. All of that. So as we go deeper into our practice, this renunciation starts to have a more ultimate meaning. Because it's not just renouncing attachment to sports cars or whatever, Hawaii, whatever our thing is, but it's recognizing they're not going to bring us ultimate happiness in this little arc of life when we're going to die. It's not going to really free us. And, you know, if we live for multiple lifetimes, just maybe, you look at it that way, it doesn't accomplish anything. you know, you become a rich person and then a rich person and then a rich person or not? How does that work? So just the last bit of what I want to say. Yeah, we're good, we're good. I want to explore for a few minutes how this ultimate nature of renunciation, what we learn from having that understanding, is related to the 16 steps of Anapanasati. And I know this is leading a little tiny bit technical maybe, but there's a connection there that's really interesting. So does anybody know what Anapanasati is? Is that any, click a bell for anybody? Not so many, okay, out there. All right, so it's in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's one of the, you know, the place, Satipatthana Sutta is where he teaches how to do mindfulness practice. This other great sutta where he teaches the 16 steps. It's called Mindfulness of Breathing, the 16 Steps of Anapanasati. And it's what the Buddha himself, when he used to do retreat, even after he was awakened, he would go off and do retreat for a month. And he would tell the monks, that's what I did. That's what I did was Anapanasati. It's really wonderful to study. It's sort of complicated. It doesn't come up so much, but at the same time, it isn't complicated because it takes us right to where we're talking about now, which is why I wanted to bring it up. So the 16 steps are divided into four tetrads, and they get subtler and deeper as you go through. Starts off with body stuff and then gets subtler and deeper. And the final three of the last tetrad, are really connected with what we're talking about and exploring here in terms of this ultimate sense of renunciation. And some great teachers have written, as usual, great books about the Anapanasati. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, who didn't write a book about it, but he talks about it, he talks about the last of these steps, showing the link with renunciation. He said the standard formula for the enlightenment factor, he says he's talking about this in the, anyway, says with regard to each that it is based on seclusion, based on dispassion, based on cessation, evolving toward relinquishment. And he says, we might see the terms seclusion, dispassion, and cessation as representing the goal toward which one aspires when undertaking the practice, and evolving toward relinquishment as indicating the inherent capacity of these factors that culminate in that goal. I was thinking today that's probably too long a quote to read, and I bet it is. But nonetheless, he's pointing in that direction. So, and I'll be brief, but it's interesting. So try to track this because it's pretty cool. The first of these last three is called dispassion. Dispassion. Doesn't it sound a lot like renunciation? Dispassion, you know, not being passionate about stuff. Dispassion. Viraga in Pali. And Buddhadasa, who was a great Thai master from the 20th century, has a book called Mindfulness of Breathing, a manual for serious meditators about these 16 steps. And he says about this 14th step of dispassion, he says, we can observe this quite easily, for example, as our erotic love for things to which we were once attached begins to fade. Anger towards past or even present objects of our displeasure dissolve away. We are no longer afraid of the things we once feared. So isn't that interesting? You know, dispassion, it frees us. He's talking about the freedom there, no longer afraid. We tend to think of it in terms of grasping, but he's saying no longer afraid of the things he once feared. The next step is cessation, nirodha. And with cessation, it becomes clear that renunciation is distilling away forms of attachment, is bringing us closer to a place where these obscurations, these clouds, melt away and the sun shines in, the light shines. Because cessation means like, you know, stopping. You know, stopping to doing the grasping. Remember that story from Angulimala? That, you know, that is Angulimala is the. I got off a slight tangent, but I think it makes sense. Yeah, sure. Angulimala was probably the world's first serial killer. How many people know the story of Angulimala? Anybody? Yeah, a few? Cool. First serial killer. Had killed 999 people. So he had a necklace around his. Mala means necklace. Anguli means finger. He had 999 fingers in a necklace around. And he was terrorizing, and he was just somehow massively powerful, and they couldn't seem to stop him, and they sent him groups of, army people to stop him, and they all got chopped up, and it ended up their fingers were around his neck, so it just wasn't working. And the Buddha arrived in this area. It was near Sravasti, out on the western range of where the Buddha sort of went back and forth up the Ganges Valley, and he knew about Angulimala, who's off in the forest there, and he said, I'm going to go off there. And everybody said, oh my God, don't. That's like, you're going to get killed. And he said, no, I'm going to go there. Everyone tried to stop him, all the villagers tried to stop him, and he just did what he was going to do. So he was walking, he was carrying his bowl. I always thought this interesting, because he'd already done his alms round, but he carries his bowl, goes off in the forest. Angulimala sees this monk come, and he says, oh, there's my 1,000th finger. Yes, sir. I'm really happy about that. So he starts chasing the Buddha with his sword, big massive sword, and he can't seem to catch him. The Buddha's just walking along, and Angulimala is running as fast as he can, and he can't catch the Buddha. And he says, stop. To the Buddha, stop. And the Buddha turns around and says, no, you stop. And suddenly Angulimala gets it. Because the Buddha wouldn't have done this unless he knew that he could have got it. He suddenly got it and went, oh, I see what you mean. So he throws down his sword, becomes a monastic, and awakens in that lifetime, by the way. So however nasty you think you all are, I bet none of you have killed 999 people. So you're way ahead of Angulimala. The point being, cessation. That was where I started with that. There's cessation. He did cessation. Angulimala did it. He stopped. So it's a powerful word. It sounds kind of like mundane, but it's really powerful. Think of what your compulsive pattern is. Could you just stop? Because you see, it ain't going to do you any good. It's just more obscurations. That's the point. Buddhadasa says, we observe the cessation of attachment, the non-existence of attachment while breathing in and breathing out. We can observe quenching or cessation from a variety of perspectives: the quenching of attachment to self, the quenching of selfishness, the quenching of greed, anger, and delusion, and the quenching of all experiences of dukkha. So catch the connection there. The quenching of selfishness and greed, anger, and delusion, and oh, by the way, all experiences of dukkha. That's suffering. Like, that's solving the suffering problem, which means awakening. So it shows you how important this is. We meditate, that's wonderful, it's important. But how we live and the attitudes that we cultivate and how we work with this renunciation is right at the core, in the way that so many things are right at the core. It's so funny, you can say, Rodney Smith was great, because he had a certain brilliance, and he would say, this is right at the core. And it always was true. It always was true. But this is too. And, remember that the first of the Four Noble Truths, that unawakened life is suffering, and the second, and it's not because it's pleasant or unpleasant, it's because of our attachment to phenomena. So we can experience phenomena as they are, but in an open-handed renunciation, then that solves the suffering thing. I mean, easier said than done, to be sure, but that is the journey. That is the journey. So this non-existence of attachment. Buddhadasa says, thus we realize the voidness or non-existence of attachment through the quenching, disappearing, and ending of attachment. We experience the absence of attachment in any of the aspects mentioned above while we breathe in and breathe out. Or more simply, We drink, taste, and savor the flavor of nibbana. Thus, to contemplate the quenching of attachment is to contemplate nibbana. So he's kind of naming it there, you know, to really let go is contemplating nibbana. And you think of, you know, like someone like Dalai Lama, you know, I mean, he's a human being like us, still alive, thank goodness. And, you know, it's like he walked down the street, but he walks down streets. You know, he walks through the woods, he walks on a path, he encounters a cat, he eats, and he does it with this incredible freedom. Does the same stuff, basically. Eats, drinks, sleeps, everything. Same stuff with this incredible freedom, just like we can. And just like all of you already partly do, because you wouldn't be here. So you're on the journey. Just keep it moving. And the last, the 16th step, is this curious word, which I can hardly even pronounce, patina isaga. And any Pali scholars will be throwing rocks at me, but that's what I got. Patina isaga. But it means, the translation is, it really buffaloed me at first, because it means throwing back or giving back. It's a way to translate it anyway. It's like, what? That's it? What is that about? But it's a way of describing liberation or ultimate freedom or ultimate renunciation, because we just give it back. We don't want it. It's pretty powerful. Buddhadasa says, we suffer dukkha because of all our attachment and thieving. As soon as we observe the way things really are through the succession of steps in this tetrad, we let go. We cease being thieves. We return everything to its original owner, nature. It all belongs to nature. Don't claim anything to be I or mine ever again. Our goal is made clear by this metaphor. It is pretty interesting. He's using, you know, thieving. When we grasp stuff, we're kind of taking it out of nature. The natural harmony of things is not about someone, you know, grasping something for them. Our four-footed friends don't do that. I mean, they, you know, they may kill an animal to eat, but they don't grasp in the same way. So we just, to let go, to give it back, to give back, you know, what we might grasp onto. So I just offer this last bit because, you know, the renunciation piece, there's a part of it that takes some choices, some willpower sometimes to not do whatever our proclivity is. And usually the thing that we want to grasp, we kind of step over someone else to get it. So often on subtle levels or not, if we take the bigger piece of pie or, you know, there's subtle stuff. We could be, you know, like having a conversation with our dearly beloved about where we're going to go on vacation, and we want to go here and they want to go there, and we omit one little detail about the problem with going to the place we want just to make sure that we actually go there. You know, it can get pretty subtle. Not that I've ever done that. But, and so we keep working on that, and that brings us freedom. That's the beautiful part about it. So this renunciation is not about self-denial. It's about freedom. That's what I said at the beginning, and that's what the end is here. And I'm going to read one last thing, and then we can see if there's any things to talk about by the Buddha. The Buddha said, but monks, he refers, as you probably know, that he refers himself as a Tathagata, the one who's arrived, is one way of doing that. But monks, the Tathagata, the Arhat, the perfectly enlightened one, having known as they really are the origin and the passing away, the enjoyment, the danger, and escape in the case of forms, does not delight in forms, is not delighted with forms, does not rejoice in forms. With the change, fading away, and cessation of forms, the Tathagata dwells happily. Having known as they really are the origin and passing away, the enjoyment, the danger and escape in the case of sounds, in the case of odors, in the case of tastes, in the case of tactile objects, in the case of mental objects, the Tathagata does not delight in mental objects, is not delighted with mental objects, does not rejoice in mental objects, with the change, fading away, and cessation of mental objects, the Tathagata dwells happily. So just because, you know, he's renouncing, he's letting go of that seeking after six sense doors he mentioned, you know, fun tactile, fun taste, fun whatever. If you don't grasp onto it, then with the inevitable arising and passing, you're not bothered by it. It's fine. He dwells happily. He dwells happily. Let's sit for a moment. So, my friends, any thoughts, questions, sharings, complaints? How does that land for you? Yeah. Thank you. For the sake of our Zoom friends. Yeah. Please. It's kind of what we do in the East Side, too. We have a place like, just like, we call it the warm seat. This is the warm seat.
I'm Jay. I've been with Sims before, and then I kind of fell out.
No. Okay. What's your name again?
Jay Clark.
Okay,
Jay. In Shoreline, Washington. But I think over the practice, it can be kind of subtle about, I'm still kind of feeling that out, you know. And I think, like, an example today, I'm more of an aversive type, but an example today, there's a one of my neighbors at the supermarket, the two-year-old daughter's offering me, or she, I think she's more like four. She's just giving me part of her treat, her little thing. And so there's a part of me that was kind of aversive to that. But really, it was just an open-hearted thing that
the kid
should have just went there and flowed with that and taken it. That was more of an act of love. But I mean, I think in meditation, maybe your experience, it can be, you know, sometimes you push. I think when I was first doing this, I was pushing things too far away.
What kind of things? When you say things, what do you mean? Like things that came up in practice? Is that what you
things
mean?
Things I dislike about myself, or it could be the opposite. It could be things. But I think when you're kind of meditation, those things that you have to be a little bit personal with it before you kind of let it go.
Say more. What's the
like in meditation? If I'm trying to think of a good aversive example, you know, like maybe like in the course of the day, somebody said something to you, which was really meant to be a little bit. I mean, perhaps it was meant to be kind of cruel, and you just kind of ignored it because you pushed it off.
That's what you're saying.
Similarly, maybe somebody said something kind to you, and you go, well, I don't deserve that, so you kind of pushed it off. I have this habit of just pushing things off sometimes. I think I'm getting better at it. That's kind of where this question is coming from, is, you don't want to, I think when I'm meditating, I want those thoughts on the concentration, but when something comes up, just kind of acknowledge it, right?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, you know,
and then let it go.
Yeah, part of, well, not, yeah, and let it, more than that, let it, it's kind of like the mindfulness, is leaning into that which arises. And where it takes us is seeing through it, you know, having it deconstruct, having it, the very triggers in you that, you know, were a little skittish about the girl and whatever, you know, or feeling this guy was a person was abrasive. So just, I think your point is well taken to turn toward, you know, there's this distinction between non-attachment and detachment is kind of in that arena too. Because detachment can mean trying to hold off. And in a sense, you're trying to make this nice little peaceful thing with everything. But that's not how life is. It comes at us. But non-attachment, when we really can step into the difficulty, right in the middle of it. And then it our relationship with it can transform. We can see, oh, you can start to, you know, you get these intuitions or insights, you know, insight that, oh, the place where I, you kind of hinted at it, the place where I'm stuck is, it's me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's, I don't know if you're, you know, or married or whatever, but.
Was, yeah.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I mean, I am too. And, you know, right there in the fire of marriage is, I guess, a great place to be mindful, because it's usually the very thing that is the great doorway is also the biggest pain in the ass, it seems like. But you have to be mindful. So I think you're kind of, what you're getting at is that it really is turning toward all phenomena and connecting, you know, being mindful of them without letting them become me. That's where the mindfulness helps us see without identifying with or adhering to.
Rather than just pushing it away altogether.
Or pushing it away, either one. You know, a lot of people, they get all hung up and stuff. That doesn't work, and you push it away.
Yeah, exactly.
That doesn't work either. You have to be present with it. But then you start the very stickiness that was the problem begins to dismantle. And that's where insight's happening. That's where wisdom's happening.
Yeah. And some meta, too.
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay.
There's that, too. Cool.
All right. Thank you.
You bet. We got Julie here online.
Hi.
Hang on a sec. This is Julie.
Can you hear me now?
Bingo. Absolutely.
Awesome. I just had a really quick comment. I wanted to say that I really appreciated the talk. A lot of it resonated with me, particularly the idea of comparing renunciation to sort of doing away with the obscurations so that the clarity can exist like the open sky. That really resonated with me. And I want to thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. It's it gets pretty simple, doesn't it?
It is.
Right?
I love it when that happens.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. We'll go for simple. Thank you very much. I mean, thank you for your recognition. See anyone here? Austin.
It was a great talk. Thank you.
You bet.
And I was curious if you could say a little bit more about why you decided to talk about Anapasati. And I appreciate the book reference there, by the way. And I already ordered it on Amazon, and it'll be at my apartment soon.
When one I by Buddhadasa? Right on.
The one that says for serious beginners. So I bought that mindfulness of the breath. But I was curious about, I think I understand why you talked about Anapasati and mindfulness of the breath in the context of renunciation. But I just was hoping that you could share a little bit more about your intention on why you decided to talk about Anapasati in the context of your talk on renunciation.
That's a good question. You know, it's, thanks for asking that. I think just because the third tetra is so interesting, and I've mulled about it a lot and practiced quite a bit, and so it just kind of clicked in my heart when I was thinking about and exploring renunciation. I went, oh, wait a minute, cessation. And I remembered that fourth tetrad. So I kind of went back and looked at it and started realizing how, you know, a lot of times in the Dharma, like one particular thread will kind of just connect with another one in some way that is surprising. So it just kind of came together in my heart. It's about all I got. Yeah, but I was aware of that last tetrad. It's just fascinating. It's one of those deals, you know, if we totally understand the Four Noble Truths, we're awakened. If we totally understand the nature of selfing or not selfing, we're awakened. Any of those things. So this one's like that. It's like, oh, wait a minute, what's he really saying? You know? So I just saw the connection. Is that kind of click? Or anything else in there? That's cool. You're getting a book, by the way.
Yeah, I think that what you said, I was just really curious what came alive for you, and it makes sense. I will say for me that one of the things I've had to renounce is thinking and trying to analyze things. My intellect I try to cut through the world with my sharp intellect, and that includes the Dharma sometimes. Let me understand what the true nature of renunciation. But when I come to mindfulness of the breath, I'm letting go of even that. Right. And I know there's a difference between thinking and knowing. And through mindfulness of the breath for me, I begin to know renunciation.
Right.
Through the practice of always returning back, beginning again, coming to the breath. So it relaxes me around this topic in a way where I say, I do know mindfulness of the breath. You know, I don't necessarily know the, you know, but that's just for me. I think I was just curious for you why you raised it. And I thought it was powerful that you mentioned mindfulness of the breath. So thank you again.
No, that's perfect. I mean, it's, you know, it's not called insight practice for nothing. I mean, that's how it works. And I'm hesitating here, but I'll go for it, I guess. So I did have the great honor of meeting Buddhadasa in 1988 in Thailand. And just for a moment, basically, I went to Swan Mok, and I was sort of on this two-week pilgrimage, and I ended up at Swan Mok, and which is in the south of Thailand. It was his Wat, and Buddhadasa is one of the great masters of the 20th century. And I sort of arrived, and the Western monk said, "Oh, everybody's off on Koh Samui. There's going to be a 10-day retreat." And I said, "Oh, darn." And he said, "What? Oh, but Buddhadasa's over there. You can go talk to him." And I went, "Really? Holy crap, really?" And so I went over there, and I was sort of moving from Raja Yoga into Buddha Dharma at that point. So the not-self thing was really puzzling for me. And I went over to him, and I said, "So is it true that there's no Atman, which is kind of the idea of self in Hinduism, in Buddhism?" And he kind of looks at me and says, "No, there's no self." He says, there's no Atman, no self. I think he just said like 8 words. And he wasn't someone you sat around and chatted with, you know. I was like, okay. But it just landed in my heart somehow. It was the darndest thing. So it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like you never know when it's going to land in your heart. And by the way, he was so unassuming. I mean, I still remember he was sitting, you know, it was Thailand, it was hot, sitting on this basically a grotty little chair surrounded by stacks of dusty magazines and chickens outside. But he was totally present. You could feel that depth radiating off him, you know, when he said that. It was like, oh, okay. So anyway, I offer that because it's sort of connected, you know, in a way, these little opening places. Thanks, Austin. Glad you're going to get the book, buddy. Tell me how it goes. It is, what is it, Buddhism for Serious Beginners? What was the title? Do you remember? Breathing for, yeah. You can look it up, Anapanasati and Buddhadasa, and you'll pick it up. Okay, anybody else? Yeah, Emery. Hi, Emery.
Hi. Thank you so much. I loved the like straight connection from this topic of renunciation to freedom, and awakening. And the thing that always trips me up when I'm thinking about clinging or attachment is relationships with people I love. And like I feel like there's potential for me to kind of let go of the rest. Like I can feel that in there. But when it comes to like especially my children, I'm like, God, you know, like I really do have hopes for them and
hopes for them.
You know, desires for them,
yeah.
Ways that I want to protect and support them. And, you know, and then as I was thinking, I was like, well, attachment, like that's a really big concept in psychology and in healthy human relationships. Like there has to be attachment. you know, partners have to be attached to each other. And of course, it's a different definition, but even just that word, like children have to attach to their caregivers and caregivers have to attach to their children, and families and communities have to be attached and connected in order to survive and thrive. And for sure, my biggest heartache is related to, like, my biggest suffering as a human is related to that attachment to the people I love, and it brings a ton of joy, but it brings also the, for me, the hardest stuff. So I have no idea how to break that pattern, or even that I want to. So I'd love to hear any wisdom you have about.
There's a journey there. I mean, there's lots of different aspects to it. You know, for one thing, things change. I mean, my daughter's 49 years old. And, you know, so she's not a little kid, by the way. So there's that. And so any attachment one had, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. So to, you know, there's kind of like, for a layperson, you know, that's why it's not as simple as polishes a pure conch shell to be in lay life, because it's much more complicated, but it's also got, as you know, heartfelt beauty to it. And there's sort of like, you know, on the one hand, there's bonding, and that's needed and beautiful. And on the other hand, there has to be an open hand, because things do change. And they're going to change. By the way, you know, your daughter will be 49 years old. Maybe you'll be around or not. You don't know for that. And maybe she'll work out great, and maybe she'll have a lot of problems. You don't know. You know, and how are you going to navigate that? But the love part, you know, to really cultivate the love in an open-hearted, open-handed kind of way, and it gets bigger. You know, it sort of frames around someone's entire journey to freedom, and the ideas that we had about the people we're close to, we have to recognize them as our ideas. I mean, when I first, you know, met my wife 35 years ago, she was a Buddhist practitioner, and I was sort of interested in getting together with a Buddhist practitioner, but I realized, you know what? I'm actually marrying a human being. Maybe she won't want to be a Buddhist, and she doesn't. Now she's not. And I didn't expect that, you know, but it's okay. I had to roll with it, and it's part of the journey. So kind of to be mindful of, you know, the idea of, you know, conventional and ultimate reality? That's more of a Mahayana framework, but yeah. So to be mindful of the conventional aspects and the ultimate aspects, and to be mindful of the ways in which one's bonding is actually one's projection and not love, you know, and to really just keep working with it so you have an open, loving hand. And I know that what kids remember going through teenagehood is that they were actually seen and heard as they become their own unique selves, you know? And so that's kind of our job as parents, is to love open-handed and love them, but open-handed. So the bond, you know, we got to be careful about when bonding is grasping or when bonding is trying to mold someone that's going to be themselves. So it's kind of in there.
Yeah, that's all very helpful. Very helpful reminders. I feel like I ask the same version, the same question all the time, but clearly I need to hear it again.
Yeah, that's beautiful though. Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. But just, you know, I mean, I'm sure your kids are like totally different. How many kids do you have?
I have three sons.
Great. Yeah, they're totally different from each other, right?
Yeah.
Okay. In a lot of ways, probably. I'm just the nature of kids, you know, I'm making this up, but I'm assuming they are. And so they all have their own amazing journeys and maybe their own karma through many, many lifetimes. Who knows? So, you know, this little 20-year span is just a blip. And so to really kind of hold it that way and honor it that way, yeah.
Thank you so loud.
So let's, I know we don't want to dedicate the merit briefly, even though that's not a Sims thing necessarily, but we do in the East Side, so it's a very traditional thing in Buddhist world. And just super briefly, that, you know, you think about this gathering, the kindness here, the awareness here of all of you. And it is indeed a bubble of light. And we can dedicate that to the well-being of beings. So first, you might think of anyone you know close to your heart who's died recently, or is suffering, who's sick, could be a four-legged, any being that's struggling. Just set them, dedicate the light and love of this gathering to their well-being, and may they be happy, and may they be healthy. May they be safe from harm. May they be free. May they live in peace. And then just extending our hearts and minds around this entire globe and people who are suffering in so many ways, people with political divisions in this country, people suffering in the Sudan, in North Korea, in Yemen, in Syria, in Central America. All these people in Myanmar, so much pain. But in the middle of that, in the middle of pain, they sometimes just can't avoid. May they be a glimmer, a glisten of freedom, a way forward. People see that. Even in the middle of pain, people see that. So let's dedicate what we've shared, that people can find a way forward in the middle of pain and not have to suffer. Okay, folks, thank you so much. May you all be well and happy and walk in peace.